White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Ladies and gentlemen and students of the International Jew, welcome to our study hour tonight, which is episode 68. The date is October 10th, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
So we're following up from last week's chapter on the evil influence of Jews in the American liquor business. The International Jew has reported on the evil influence of Jews in the theater and movie business, Jews in the newspaper and magazine publishing business, Jews in politics and government, in diplomacy and creating wars, Jews in law, Jews in high finance, Jews in farming. Have I missed anything, Hadding?
I don't know.
Well, anyway, everything they go into,
Jews
I like
in to... Zionism in Palestine.
Yeah, I didn't.
Pushing
I
the people
I left that
out.
Yeah, we did. They cover Palestine, too. But, you know, I do like to just emphasize that as much as possible, that everything they touch, they destroy. And this is another. I'm surprised at some of the things they say in this chapter. They're some very strong statements. I'll point the one out where they that when we come to it that I thought was pretty neat. So they're telling us things about the liquor trust that is just kind of unbelievable because it was right out there in everybody's face. Mm. Seems to me. So you want to start reading our chapter 64?
Sure. Chapter 63.
Oh, 64, isn't it?
Looks like LXIII to me.
Well, I got the wrong chapter. What was last week?
Gigantic 62. Jewish liquor.
Yeah, you're right. It's 63. I got it in there wrong. Thank you.
Chapter 63 of the International Jew. Gigantic Jewish Liquor Trust and its career. It has been shown how the American whiskey business became Jewish. The distillers of pure whiskey, which required years to make, were driven out by the manufacturers of drugged and chemicalized liquors, which could be made in 3 or 4 hours. The latter, being cheaper and more intoxicating, so completely usurped the market that the public never knew that it was not whiskey. It had stolen the name of whiskey, and under that name the righteous indignation of the people prohibited it. Talking about prohibition of whiskey in the early 20th century. And under that name still it is being sold by bootleggers at an advance of 1,000%.
Now what does that mean? They're making 1,000% on what they sell? Over what
yeah,
it costs?
Yeah, I'd say that's what it means. Yeah.
God.
The use of the fraudulent label is not new. It is not a product of Prohibition days. It began with the advent of Jewish capital into the liquor business. Whiskey, carefully and scientifically made, purified by long years of repose in the warehouse, was an American product. Red Eye, 40 Rod Stuff, Knock 'em Dead, and Squirrel Whiskey, mixed and sold the same day, were Jewish products.
Yeah, they went into that last week, and just to remind people, you know, it's just amazing that whiskey, and I used to think bourbon was a better grade of whiskey, and whiskey was some cheap product. Oh, I see how wrong I was. I suppose that was what they wanted you to believe, huh? And but you know, that was, which is supposed to age for, just like wine, you know, for years in these barrels to be good, and used to be that way. Now they just mix this stuff up, and here they even say they mix and sell it on the same day. God.
And call it 9 years old, because it chemically approximates 9 year old whiskey.
Yeah, or even if they don't, they still call it whiskey, you know, as though it's the same thing that, you know, has always been whiskey. Now I realize too that whiskey is a, is the real name, and it's a, and it's an honorable name, whiskey. It's not a kind of a,
you know what is a really key thing in that paragraph is where it says that the Jewish whiskey, so-called, is cheaper and more intoxicating. I think that really gets to the core of the problem right there. They were making very high alcohol content bottled drinks at a low price. So that means that, it means that ne'er-do-wells with very little money could get rip-roaring drunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, right. That is the whole point, and that's the complaint, the main complaint that they have beyond the fact that they were criminalizing and they were fraudulent and they were all making a whole bunch of money, but they were destroying human lives, not of Jews either, naturally, of non-Jews.
The Pure Food Law came into the fight to protect the American industry. But it was flouted at every turn. See, that's inadequate enforcement of regulations right there. Mm-hmm. We get these so-called conservatives railing against regulation all the time. Whose interest are they serving?
Yeah, Jews. The businesses. That's whose interest. Yeah.
Well, they're serving Jewish interests. Unscrupulous capitalist interests, we could say, euphemistically, but really means Jews. I mean, first and foremost. Bad liquor was in such a deep state of public disgrace that the people paid little attention to Chief Chemist Wiley's efforts. They thought, when he said whiskey, he meant the stuff that they knew as whiskey, and they disregarded him. The degeneracy of the liquor business became deeper and deeper, to the amazement of both its friends and its foes. And no one had the key to the situation, because no one saw, or seeing, had courage to expose the Jewish program behind the scenes. To resume the story, even after the cheap compounded liquors, which masqueraded as whiskey, had won a commanding place in the market, to the serious detriment of the business in pure brands, the Jewish compounders were far from satisfied. There remained a few American brands whose names, by reason of their dependability, topped the list. Their very quality, though of limited quantity, was a constant challenge to the vicious mixtures of which the rectifiers produced millions of gallons a year. How to remove those standard American brands with their honest labels from the market? That was the problem which the leaders of the Jewish compounding business tackled. Here we're getting into something like a conspiracy.
I'm going to bring that up a little bit later, so I'm glad you're saying that, because clearly they were.
Well, it's how they're interpreting it anyway. If you take this description at face value, it's a conspiracy.
Well, I think it is. I think it is right what they're saying.
May very well be. It sounds like a cartel.
Well, yeah, it was.
The first resort was, characteristically, to trickery. Shipments of pure goods would be sidetracked to somewhere en route, while the rectifiers drew off half the whiskey and refilled the barrels with mixed compounds.
That's criminality right there, just downright criminal, right?
Yeah, it's just outright theft.
Yeah.
People who have been amazed at the stunts of the bootleggers the sidetracking of whiskey shipments, the robbery of loaded trucks, and so on, would not be so surprised if they knew that every trick was used by the compounders of bad liquor 20 years ago. It was Jewish then, as it is Jewish now. But no one dared say so. Merely to list the tricks would require too much space. It was a nasty business from any point of view. But still, the standard brands held their place in public confidence. The Jew who claims to be the superior of the American in skill did not think of making a better whiskey and thus winning the market. He thought to get rid of the better whiskey that the vicious adulterated product might own the field. It was the day of trusts. Big business was amalgamating. It occurred.
Now, let me just ask, at this time, trusts were not illegal. That came later where they had the trust laws.
Yeah, it's like Sherman
laws.
Antitrust law
from
late 19th century, like 1890s, I believe, or maybe even 19-aught something.
Well, we're talking about 1890s, the very end of the 1890s here. So it was. Do we have antitrust then in this country?
Well, you know, Standard Oil had a monopoly on oil for a while. Mm-hmm. Rockefeller did.
Yeah.
You know, and the Sherman antitrust law required them to break up, and I think they then formed corporations. Separate corporations that probably had the same people on the board, all their boards of directors, but
they find a way around it. But anyway, so this was not legal. This wasn't legal at this time they were doing this. Maybe earlier than this, but some of the dates they give start at 1898 and 1899 for a lot of things they say here. So it would have been that the trust would have been not been acceptable that they were doing it anyway.
It was the day of trusts. Big business was amalgamating. It occurred to the leaders of the compounding business that if they could sweep all the honest distilleries into a combine with all the backroom rectifying places, put them all under one management, and run down the quality of famous brands to the standard of cheap ones, cashing in on the names of the brands and doubly profiting by decreasing the cost which quality requires, they could thus accomplish in a financial way what had been formerly tried by less respectable methods. The inception of the idea of a whiskey combine was legitimate. The Kentucky distillers, who must at all times be distinguished from compounders and rectifiers, endeavored in 1898 to establish a combination that would unite all the legitimate distilleries in the fight against the flood of counterfeit whiskey. It is, however, significant that there was not enough capital in the legitimate whiskey business to finance the plan. But when the idea was picked up by the makers of spurious liquor, there were millions of dollars at their command. Just as today, with industry suffering, there are millions of Jewish capital at the disposal of the motion picture business. In the Louisville Courier Journal, February 1899, the story of the first operations toward a combine is told. The language being inflated, of course, that hesitant distilleries might be stampeded.
Yes, people need to recognize what they're saying here is that a lot of this that they're quoting from the newspapers is in a sense a propaganda that the Jews are trying to put out through their news stories to make these other distillers think that there was no hope of them remaining independent, that everybody was going into their groups.
Yeah.
so on, right?
Absorbed! Kentucky distilleries in a mammoth combine. Capital stock, $32 million. Some of the biggest plants in the state involved. 16 in Louisville. Controls 90% of the product and nearly all standard brands. Levy Meyer of Chicago has acted as counsel in the drawing up of the papers. He becomes the general counsel of the new company. This article contained a list of Kentucky distilleries, all of them American, that is, non-Jewish. It was the well-established brands, the names of quality, that were sought. These names were all non-Jewish. Levy Meyer, the general counsel of the new company, said tonight.
Hattie, yep. We got a phone call, so I answered it. And if it's somebody, since we don't have a real long read right. tonight, if sure. it's somebody who has something brief and really relevant, then go ahead, caller.
Sure, let him talk.
Hello, hello, caller. Yeah?
Hello, may I speak with Michelle, please?
Oh, brother.
Ain't no Michelle here, bro. You got the wrong number.
I'm sorry about that. You have a wonderful evening, sir.
You're welcome.
All right. Please. Okay, goodbye. I wonder, I might have to hang this. Oh, he's gone. Okay. Well, I should have known it wouldn't be, you know, nobody who really listens to this show calls in. So that was funny, wasn't it? Sorry to interrupt you, Hattie. Go ahead. Go back a little bit.
Levy Meyer, the general counsel of the new company, said tonight, the Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company is a reality and will bring a prosperity to the state of Kentucky, where depression has prevailed for some years on account of the discord which has existed among the distillers of bourbon whiskey, who for a generation prior enjoyed a great prosperity. A most ingenuous statement, but Mr. Meyer is a most ingenuous man. However, there is some truth in his statement. It was true that the legitimate distillers had suffered from depression, not because the American people were not consuming liquor, however, but because the American people had been turned from pure whiskey to red eye, and Mr. Meyer's smooth statement that this depression was on account of the discord which has existed among the distillers of bourbon whiskey needs revision to the fight between the non-Jewish makers of real whiskey, and the Jewish makers of compounded liquor. In the story of the combine, a great deal is heard of Mr. Meyer and Alfred Austrian. Meyer is a Chicago Jew who is worth a story by himself. He's one of those Jews with whom candidates for the American presidency, mostly those candidates who are in debt, feel it necessary to stay when he invites them.
That's sickening to me. That's so yeah. sickening. You know, there are presidential candidates. But that's what these people seem to know.
Yeah, some of them, of course, had secret debts, like Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah. But, you know, catering like that to known big old criminal Jews, jeez. Ugh.
Mr. Austrian is sufficiently well known by his connection with the baseball scandal. He was attorney for Rothstein, the gambler, whose name figured so prominently in that scandal and who is credited with doing things to the grand jury testimony in a way that makes a pretty tale. Austrian also appeared for two St. Louis Jew gamblers implicated in the baseball scandal who were afterward indicted. Austrian is also credited with being the author of the so-called Lasker Plan of baseball reorganization. The services of Meyer and Austrian to the liquor interests of Chicago and Cook County were and are important.
Yeah, this Austrian really got around. I wish he had a different name. I mean, it's hard to say his name and people realize we're talking about a person. But that, see, this Jews, once again, they take these names, you know, that they have no right to. Takes the name of a whole darn country, or the people of that country.
And yeah, well, if you see somebody with the surname German, almost certainly not a German.
I bet, right, that's right. That's
that
right.
Will be a Jew.
Yeah.
Or
and,
Deutsch.
And, yeah, and this Austrian, you know, we talked about him quite a bit in the, or they wrote about him quite a bit in the baseball scandal. And that's another area I didn't, I forgot in my opening remarks that they've also written about Jews in sports and particularly in baseball. Yep.
There were Jewish names previously appearing. About 1889, Nathan Hoffmeyer had tried to bring...
Hoffheimer,
yeah. About 1889,
Hoffmeyer, what's the difference?
About 1889, Nathan Hoffmeyer had tried to bring all the Kentucky whiskey business under one head. And later, Morris Greenbaum tried it. It will probably be conceded that both these men are Jews, and it is provable by the records that they were endeavoring to consolidate the whiskey business. But the big stunt was really pulled off under the guidance of the two Chicago Jews, Meyer and Austrian. The various companies forming the trust are American Spirits Manufacturing Company, $35 million. Kentucky Distilling and Warehouse Association, $32 million. The Rye Whiskey Distillers Association, $30 million. The Standard Distilling Company, $28 million. And the Spirits Distributing Company, $7,500,000. The forerunner of the gigantic combination of the whiskey interests of the country was the organization of the American Spirits Manufacturing Company upon the ruins of the old Whiskey Trust, which was controlled and directed by Joseph Greenhut.
It was Greenhut, remember? I mentioned him last week from Peoria.
Yeah.
And Chicago. He started out in Chicago.
Attorney Levy Meyer of Chicago, who has been legal advisor of the whiskey people from the inception of the American Spirits Manufacturing Association, was called to New York Saturday last, to confer over the legal form of the charter and the closing of the negotiations. The italicized portions, and that was on Attorney Levi Meyer and American Spirits Manufacturing Association.
Oh.
The italicized portions indicate the connection, and it was a connection maintained to the end and may indeed be continued yet.
So you then, have italics in the version that you pick up.
Yeah.
See, mine doesn't show any italics. All that's been removed.
Does
I
it
never
refer to italics?
No, I mean there's no italics in the.
I should have asked that if he'd been drinking tonight.
He should have continued listening. We should have invited him to stay on and listen.
Yeah, I was talking to you a minute here about your liquor habits. What's you been drinking tonight?
Well, we're going to be talking about that a little bit here.
When you drink, what do you drink?
Now, you'd be insulting him if you did that to him.
Yeah. Then, in the current accounts of this merger of the liquor business under Jewish control, another name appears. I feel bad now. He was polite.
Yes. But I don't know how he could end up calling our show and then waiting while he's listening to us and think he's going to get Michelle. I don't know about that, but yeah. I've been kind of wondering about
you
that.
Call in from a telephone?
Yeah.
Okay, that's
well, I don't know. He'd have to because he doesn't have a Skype connection with us. He doesn't, you know, we don't have a Skype contact with this person, whoever he is. So he'd had to have called on the phone.
Yeah.
So it's kind of strange, isn't it? That'd be called program. think you're going to get this.
Well, maybe the
Michelle
White Network's telephone number is close to the number of a liquor store.
You're just determined to push that.
Then in the current accounts of this merger of the liquor business under Jewish control, another name appears on March 15th, 1899. Angelo Meyer, a big whiskey buyer of New York, is in Louisville trying to buy a big lot of whiskeys. It appears that Mr. Myers put on a poor mouth and told how hard it was to buy whiskey in big lots.
Well, now, don't make the mistake of calling him Mr. Myers. I think Myers is always German. I had an uncle named
what
Myers.
It says,
but
it says Angelo Meyer, and then it says Mr. Myers.
It's two different not mine words. Doesn't. Somebody.
I've also got two different versions of his first name. I've got L-E-V-I and L-E-V-Y.
Oh, well, some kind of sloppy there. I've just got Mr. Meyer here. Sorry. I think the Jewish Meyer is always just Meyer. Mm-hmm. Anyway. And you know, here's, you've got Meyer, and then this is Angelo Meyer. The other guy's name is spelled M-A-Y-E-R, and you are pronouncing it Meyer. So, my goodness.
It appears that Mr. Meyer put on a poor mouth and told how hard it was to buy whiskey in big lots. And then on March 17th, 2 days later, this appeared. Mr. Angelo Meyer, the wealthy Philadelphia whiskey man, has been appointed one of the general managers of the business of the Kentucky Distilleries Company, and is engaged in appointing men to take charge of the various departments of the combine's affairs. The discrepancy in the above two paragraphs need not be charged to the untruthfulness of the newspaper reporter. Reporters, as a rule, faithfully report what they are told. But sometimes what they are told is not true, and sometimes they twist things, too.
Yeah.
Mr. Meyer has commonly been called the Napoleon of the whiskey trade. Mm-hmm. He is largely interested in the recently formed combine.
We intend to make plenty of whiskey. No brand will be killed. Said Mr. Meyer.
Henceforth, the names of Levy Meyer, Levy Meyer, Alfred Austrian, and Angelo Meyer appear most frequently in the reports. Alfred Austrian, who is Levy Meyer's legal representative, says that all the distilleries now negotiated for will be absorbed in 3 weeks more, after 3 more weeks.
Mm-hmm.
In an interview today, Mr. Angelo Meyer said,
I believe confidently that in the next 5 years, a business calling for 10 million gallons of whiskey a year will be built up.
In April 1899, another Jewish movement appeared. Joseph Wolf, the Chicago whiskey dealer who is known to own more Kentucky whiskey, independent of the Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company, than any other individual or corporation, is behind the new whiskey combine formed in Chicago, with a capital stock of $3 million. The purpose of the new trust, which it is said will be given the title of the Illinois Distilleries and Warehouse Company, is to fight the Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company. The Illinois Distilleries and Warehouse Company versus Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company. Jews in Illinois, apparently.
Yes. Yeah, so here you go. You know, they even admit that they're forming this big combine in order to fight some other company and, in essence, destroy it or take it over or whatever. You know, I mean, it's just all a big battle. And business was like that, and there was seemed to be not much, as you were saying before, regulation on what people were doing.
The few remaining Kentucky distillers were wary. They regarded Wolf, probably with reason, as simulating enmity to the other part of the Jew-made whiskey trust. Oh, because these were both Jewish trusts, the Kentucky and the Illinois trust. In order to sweep into his net the remaining independents, Aha, false opposition.
Yeah.
Alfred Austrian and C.H. Stoll, attorneys for the Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company, will leave Louisville today for Chicago to confer with Levy D. Meyer, chief counsel for the trust, and in fact, counsel for three big whiskey and spirit combines.
You know, three of these guys are all lawyers, but Alfred Austrian seems to be the one who acts as the actual attorney for them, but these others are counsel for the companies. I mean, you know, I think every Jew is a lawyer and every lawyer is a Jew, practically. Are they really?
Yeah, I have an acquaintance who's a lawyer. He said, you don't want to get into law. It's full of Jewy people.
Yeah.
I think most lawyers today are Jews in the United States. I think that's true. A lot of them.
Yeah, I'd say probably the majority. I wouldn't be surprised. That only takes 51%.
Certainly in some states, I would say, anyway.
Yeah.
Alfred Austrian of Chicago left last night for Cincinnati to close the deal for the celebrated Sam Clay Distillery of Bourbon County.
Bourbon County.
Yeah, in Kentucky. Under an exciting headline detailing the departure of the Jew lawyer Austrian to Chicago to see the Jew lawyer Meyer, there is the story of a still greater whiskey combine.
You know, this may be what I was thinking of, is somewhere where he was calling people Jew. You know, and instead of saying Jewish lawyer, they're coming down to calling them Jew lawyer. This Jew lawyer against that Jew lawyer. Pretty strong, I think. Pretty good. Sorry to have interrupted you at a point.
No, it's all right. I was just taking a sip. Okay. It's not whiskey. The projected combination of all the whiskey interests of the country will probably be completed in Chicago today. A rye whiskey trust is now being formed and will soon be ready for incorporation and presentation to men with capital. It is said that the capitalization of the rye whiskey trust will be $60 million, and the combined capitalization of the five companies will amount to $175 million. Levy Meyer of Chicago, Alfred Austrian of Chicago, and C.H. Stoll of New York are the attorneys for the three trusts, Mr. Meyer being the chief counsel.
Now, you know, they brag about how much money in all these news stories. They, you know, talk about these so many millions, and that was a huge amount then, much more than it is today. And they don't have any problem bragging about how much money all this is involved. No wonder there was this prohibition came along, because people probably were outraged when they saw all the money that how this drinking and all the damage that it did to so many families and so on was. How rich it was making these people.
Well, he said that the purpose of all this publicity was to intimidate these small independent distillers.
Yeah, but while they were doing it, you know, and they may have been exaggerating even, but still, it was showing people, if they were reading this, how much money was involved in alcohol sales.
Okay. And still later, a statement by Levy Meyer. The new rye distillery combination will be the largest individual whiskey amalgamation in the world. It is controlled and is being financed by the same people and the same trust companies of New York and Philadelphia, now controlling and financing the Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company, whose value is $32 million. The standard distilling and distributing company with a capital of $28 million, the American Spirits Manufacturing Company with a capital of $35 million, and the Spirits Distributing Company with a capitalization of $15 million. Rumor has it, and Mr. Meyer smiled as he patted a big bundle of legal documents, that after the rye consolidation has been perfected, all the separate companies will be merged
into one central company, which will have an aggregate capital close to $200 million. A whiskey combination of that size will certainly hold foremost place among the world's liquor trusts and organizations.
Huh, bragging.
Another dispatch. Alfred Austrian today returned to Louisville from New York, where he assisted in forming the combine of the American Spirits Manufacturing Company and the three other companies. Mr. Austrian leaves tonight for Chicago, where he expects to close the deal with Elias Bloch and Sons to purchase the Darling Distillery in Carroll County, and with Freiberg and Workham to secure their two plants in Boone County. Here it is possible to see the Jewish agents, here it is possible to see the Jewish agents of Jewish capital. It's like the newspaper thing when I do that Maxwell Smart voice. Here it is possible to see the Jewish agents of Jewish capital hurrying to and fro with every assurance of success, working along well-defined lines, known to themselves, but concealed from the public, building up a colossal structure which public opinion was to hurl down in 2 decades. But 2 decades were enough for enormous revenues to be derived from the criminal debasement of all kinds of liquor, which became more apparent from the time of the giant consolidation.
Well, here's where I think it shows some conspiracy talk, you know, when they say that they were working along well-defined lines, these Jews, going here and there. They knew what they were all about. It was all known to them, but concealed from the public. And then, of course, they say that it was criminal debasement of all kinds of liquor, and so on. So they were carrying out a criminal conspiracy. They should have been.
I'm not sure that what they're doing was really criminal at the time. Trying to establish a monopoly is considered criminal now, but a lot of things used to not be criminal, like manipulating the stock market used to be legal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, but I'm just saying that whether it was actually a crime at the time, what we know of as conspiracy was taking place.
It does appear they were deliberately trying to take over all of the liquor industry.
Yeah, and that just goes to show that really they want to take over all of everything that they get into if they can. They would like to take over all of the media. They have, and nobody even says a word when they know that it's 100% or 95 or 98% Jewish. You know, there's a little bit that's not. Then look at the Federal Reserve and so on. I mean, it's all Jewish and all Jewish names. They take over all the
I think you're overstating a little bit. You see, there's a lot of media that's owned by non-Jews, but those non-Jews don't have any sense of purpose about resisting Jewish pressure. That's the thing.
Okay.
Most of them, all right?
There isn't a lot
of traction out of organized pressure, not through necessarily owning everything.
But it's a known fact that they own about 95%.
No, I think that's an overstatement.
Well, you come up with the proof. You come up with it.
Well, I was looking at the list of the top 6 media conglomerates in the United States, and about 3 out of 6 are definitely very Jewish. One of them is Disney, and they have a Jewish CEO, but they have a lot of non-Jews
They put non-Jews
on the board of directors, right?
Yeah, they put non-Jews there. All the cooperating goy, you know.
And then you got Fox.
Still Jewish.
And it's hard to say whether Murdoch's a Jew or not. You know, we think he might be a Jew, but
he still serves the Jewish interests.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's as I say, though, it's I mean, I'm not saying that you see that.
Okay, well, let's not get into
that. It's probably hard to survive as a media outlet if you're not friendly with the Jews. Well, we could probably say that. But I don't think they directly control as much media as you were saying.
You're the one that says all the time, oh, it's the media, you know, that they're... The big problem is the only real big problem with Jews is the media, and now you're saying they don't even control the media.
Well, a lot of the influence of Jews is not through being the CEO. It's a lot of it is staff.
You don't have to be the CEO.
The names.
They could put another CEO there. That's not
the names of the in the credits on TV shows. The people that put the show together and are responsible for decisions. Yeah, lots of Jews there.
You know what? You say you don't even have TV and haven't had it for so long. So where are you watching TV? That was a long time.
I used to watch it a long time ago.
Well, I know. So did I. A long time ago. Okay, let's go.
Whiskey became so rotten that in Kentucky, I remember names like Sherman Schwartz and, you know.
Yeah.
Wolper Productions, stuff like that. Lots of Jewish production companies. Whiskey became so rotten that in Kentucky, the pioneer whiskey state, there were only four whole wet counties by 1908. The first decade of absolute Jewish control put even the first whiskey state in the dry column. The Jewish compounders did not care how they marketed their goods, so long as they could sell them in quantities. The cheap barrel house appeared with its windows full of gleaming bottles and gaudy labels and cut-rate whiskey prices. The compounders became saloon owners toward the end of the saloon era, and many Jews went into the barrel house business for quick cleanup. The proportion of vicious dives increased everywhere, and the moral guardians of society were amazed at the wave of vice that was sweeping over the country. But they did not have the key that explained it. The whiskey business was riding to a wild finish, but the men at the helm knew exactly what they were doing every moment of the time. To look back upon that period, with all the facts at hand, makes it more and more apparent how fitting is the term boob Gentile. Why, even Norman Hapgood knew how bad it was, and Collier's Weekly, under his editorship, was the first journal in the land to print the names of Jews in connection with the liquor debauchery of the country. But those were the good old days when Hapgood could tell the truth even about Hearst, the man for whom he now writes his graceless palaver of pro-Jewish propaganda. In Collier's Weekly, during the year 1908, solid truths appeared, which are in point today as proofs of what was transpiring. There was a specially scathing attack on what was called nigger gin, a peculiarly vile beverage which was compounded to act upon the Negro in a most vicious manner. Will Irwin spoke of this gin as the king iniquity in the degenerated liquor traffic of these United States. This author and Collier's started a new fashion in giving publicity not only to the names of certain brands of liquors, but also the names of the men who made them. And that's William Henry Irwin, who was apparently a famous muckraker journalist. Born in Oneida, New York. It turned out that the maker of a brand of nigger gin, which had spurred certain Negroes on to the nameless crime, was one Lee Levy.
Now, is the nameless crime rape? What is the nameless crime?
That would be it, yeah.
That's what I figured. Okay.
It's
funny how they call it the nameless crime. Is that a word that wasn't used in good company at the time? You couldn't come out and say that, I guess. in front of ladies or something.
Well, there was a lot of sensitivity about that. As a matter of fact, from what I've read, the main reason for lynchings of Negroes in the South was to save women who had been raped the trauma of having to testify in court.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I read that. That's right. They want to deny today, all these liberals, that Southern Negroes ever raped white women. They wouldn't dare do such a thing down there, but they did do it, didn't they?
Because the South is not through with, this is Mr. Irwin. Mr. Irwin wrote, because the South is not through with Lee Levy, and because its citizens may at least drive him out of business if they cannot get him behind the bars, one declaration of the commercial appeal is worthy of reply. That paper raises a question of fact. It charges that Levy's gin, Dreyfus, Weil and Company's gin, Blumenthal and Blickert's gin, the Old Spring Distilling Company's gin, do not exist, or that if they exist, their sales are insignificant. Let me present my own evidence on that point. Mr. Irwin then details some of his experiences. The gin which he was discussing was provocative of peculiar lawlessness. Its labels bore lascivious suggestions and were decorated with highly indecent portraiture of white women. I bought for evidence many other brands, some emanating from the big liquor cities and some put up by local people. But I could always get Levy's. I never saw it in any saloon which bars the Negro. In Galveston, which prides itself on its clean government, some brand or other was for sale in nearly all the corner grocery drums.
In
a Negro street of New Orleans, I saw 5 saloon shop windows in one block, which displayed either Lee Levy's or Dreyfus, Weil and Company's. This latter firm is more clever in its work than the others, much more delicate and subtle in its labeling policy. It takes one who understands the Negro and his slang to appreciate the enigma of their wording. It all comes in a caution label on the obverse of the bottles. Such gins were sold
everywhere. So on the front of the bottle, they had these provocative pictures or whatever, I don't know, that somehow, you know, Negroes understood and liked. And then on the back of it, they had their caution label, and then they give some kind of warning, about what's in that, yeah. But
warning, this shit gonna mess you up.
You're gonna end up in jail. Yeah.
Don't you be raping no hoes after you drink this. Whatever. Such gins were sold everywhere in Birmingham. A bottle of the stuff, half empty, had been taken from a Pickens County Negro just after his arrest for the nameless crime. I was just looking at old newspaper articles, and there are lots of them. If you do a Google newspaper archive search on nigger gin, you'll get a lot of hits. And they'll talk about people drinking that stuff and then committing crimes, just as it says. And it says, in fact, that this was the reason why Prohibition was popular in the South.
I'm sure it was a direct result of drinking that stuff, yeah.
Levy, so the gossip of the liquor trade has it, grew rich through this department of his business. Dreyfus, Weil and Company advertise everywhere that theirs is the most widely sold brand in the South. That means to Negroes. And more, one hears of tragedies that lie at the end of this course. That is a sample, an expurgated sample, of what went on in every part of the country. Newspaper reporters will remember how the police used to wonder about the change that came over certain foreign communities. "They come here nice people," the experienced police captain would say, "but in a short time they are giving us all sorts of trouble. They don't do that in their own country." "It's the drink," somebody would suggest. "No, they drink in their own country. They drink all the time there. It's the kind of drink they get here that does it. The rot gut that drives them wild." That was the captain's diagnosis, made 1,000 times, but no one was the wiser. No one saw the key, which was the Jew. In the South, a terrible lynching period came and divided the country into pro-lynching and pro-Negro parties. But still, no one saw the reason for it all. The race question rose to threatening proportions. The Americans of North and South looked at each other askance. There was a cooling of sympathy between the regions. Northerners were inclined to look at Southerners as unjust and inhuman in their treatment of the Negro. And Southerners were inclined to look upon Northerners as temperamentally unsympathetic and stupidly ignorant of what the conditions were. Behind it all were the products of men like Lee Levy and Dreyfus Wyland Company, to use only the names quoted from Collier's. The ancient Jewish policy of divide, conquer, destroy was in operation. Jewish policy favors disunion as a preparation to the kind of union which Jewish leaders want. Jewish influence was strong for disunion in the Civil War. Jewish influence is directly behind the present attitude of the Negro toward the white man. Look at the so-called Negro welfare societies with their hordes of Jewish officials and patrons. Jewish influence in the South is today active in keeping up the memory of the old divisions, and with reference to the Negro question, nigger gin, the product of Jewish poisoned liquor factories, was its most provocative element. I would say that the NAACP to this day is controlled by Jews, at least financially. Yeah. And Ben Jealous looks like a Jew to me.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth in all that, with this paragraph you just read.
Trace the appearance of this gin as to date, and you find the period when Negro outbursts and lynching became serious. Trace the localities where this gin was most widely sold, and you will find the places where these disorders prevailed. It is extremely simple, so simple that it has been overlooked. The public is being constantly deceived by an appearance of complexity where there is none. When you find the fever-bearing mosquito, yellow fever is no longer a mystery. The same policy of divide, conquer, destroy tells the story of the liquor traffic. Jewish influence divided between distilling and compounding, drove out distilling, and in the end destroyed the traffic as a legalized entity. It needs to be said, however, that the destruction is not part of the Jewish intention. Divide and conquer is the formula as the Jewish leaders conceive it, as indeed it is stated in the protocols. The destroy comes as nemesis upon Jewish achievements. Russia was divided and conquered, but just as the Jews had conquered it, the cankerworm of fate began to consume their conquest. The story is repeated wherever Jewish intrigue has succeeded. Whatever the Jews can succeed in making Jewish falls.
Yeah, the USA. Are we going to fall? Is the USA going to fall?
That. We can say that the USA is a declining power for sure. Mm-hmm. It may be fate. It may be destiny's way to the survival of the fittest. That which succumbs to complete Judaization, as Jewish leaders conceive it, may deserve to fall. The justification of its destruction may appear in the possibility of its Judaization. Anything that can be Judaized is, to that extent, sentenced to oblivion. The story of Jewish control of liquor has now been carried through two stages, the divide and conquer stages. The third stage follows with swift and relentless steps. Blind though the country was to the Jewish character of the liquor business, it was not blind to the ravages of that business upon society. There came a sentiment that moved ceaselessly through the country and mounted to stormy power. People could only speak of it as a wave. The term became hackneyed by overuse, but it was accurately descriptive. The indignation of the people, the arousal of their just moral resentment, was as a flood which rose to cleanse the land. The attack was on liquor, and the attack was just. The attack was on liquor, and it came none too soon. The country was drenched in vile concoctions, which rapidly undermined large sections of the population. Crime increased, and domestic misery was everywhere. The people attacked the only thing they could see. They attacked the stuff and the places that distributed it. They did not see the $200 million Jewish whiskey combination. They did not see the sinister devices by which strong drink was made vile and viler with the growth of Jewish control. The people rose and swept away the saloon. They did not sweep away the stocks of liquor. They did not sweep away Jewish interest in liquor. They left the source untouched, and that source is still existent. There remains another chapter of the narrative, the coming of prohibition and of the illicit traffic in liquor. The illicit traffic in liquor. It remains to be seen whether the same thread carries through the latter phases.
Okay.
24th December, 1921.
You know, now here at the end, it's a real good place to say that instead of sweeping away the saloon and the liquor, they should have swept away the Jews, because the Jews were the source of the deterioration of liquor, decent liquor. Nothing wrong with liquor in itself. Well, for the most part, at least the way they talked, the way it used to be, it didn't have this deleterious effect on people, you know, the right kind. And there wasn't so much of it, you know, it took a long time, so there was never so much of it produced, like this cheap stuff. This has been very, very enlightening to me. I really didn't know a lot of this, never thought much about it. So, that's very good. And next week we're going to read about prohibition.
Yeah. The Jewish element in bootlegging evil.
Yeah. And so what do you think? Yeah. Why couldn't we? What we need to get understand that to stop all these evils and all these areas of our society that I mentioned earlier, we just need to sweep away the Jews.
Well, yeah, it has to do with, you know, there's this Christian idea that you want to attack the sin and not the sinner.
That's wrong.
You just can't fix problems that way. You know, there's certain kinds of people that do certain kinds of things. And as long as you have those people around, you're going to have problems.
That's it.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.